You are listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society, an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars dedicated to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about our annual conference, our journal Pietas, our mailing list, and more, visit our website at ciceroniansociety.org. As this is my first time hosting an episode of The Sower, let me introduce myself. I am Christopher Annadale, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Mount St. Mary's University and Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland, where I also direct the Master of Arts in Philosophical Studies program. I run a philosophy channel on YouTube, and my personal podcast, Life After Philosophy, is available on all platforms. I have been a supporter of the Ciceronian Society since near the beginning, back around 2012, and I'm grateful for the fellowship and community the Society's provided me over the years. I feel like it's my intellectual home. This episode is the first in an occasional series focused on the theme of place. We will talk to different people about the places they come from, how they are rooted there, and their reflections on what it means to have or to lack a place. Here we go. For this episode, our place is Auburn, Alabama. And our guest, who will introduce us to Auburn, is Dr. Alan Mendelhall. He is Associate Dean and Grady Rosier Professor at the Sorrell College of Business and Executive Director of the Manuel H. Johnson Center for Political Economy at Troy University in Troy, Alabama. He attended the 2024 Ciceronian Society Conference in Plano, Texas, where some of our listeners may have seen his talk on ESG, Untying the Ties That Bind. Alan, welcome to The Sower.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you today.
So why don't you tell us a bit about your place, which is Alabama, Auburn, and environs. I understand you have some deep attachment to it and some family history in it. What should we know about Auburn?
Well, I live in Auburn. I earned my PhD in Auburn. And both my parents went to Auburn, and all four of my grandparents either lived in Auburn or attended Auburn University or graduated from Auburn University. On my maternal side, the family actually goes back to the founding of Auburn, specifically East Alabama Male College, which did require a move by the legislature to create, but it was a private Methodist school. And it was pretty much a failure, actually. It wasn't going to last. But after the Morrill Act, this is all taking place in the 19th century. And after the Morrill Act, when Alabama was looking to establish a new land-grant institution, the legislature determined to do that in Tuscaloosa, where the University of Alabama already was. Well, some of the legislators stayed back after the session and pulled a bunch of shenanigans and moved this land grant to Auburn. And that required the acquisition, the takeover of East Alabama Male College. And the new land grant university was called Alabama Agricultural and Mechanical College, which later became Alabama Polytechnic Institute, which later became Auburn University, the name that everyone knows the university by today. And one interesting thing about living in a university town is that when you have this tradition, for example, my mom grew up in Opelika, and so there's a heritage that I have that's sort of genealogical. But you also have the traditions that are tied to the university. And when I was looking to get a PhD, I was already a practicing lawyer. I didn't need and get a PhD, but I felt so compelled to get a degree from Auburn, and I wanted to get a degree in literature because I always wanted to do it for my own sake, not because I needed it for a career, but because I just wanted to continue my studies in literature. And I enrolled in Auburn and did my PhD at Auburn and joined the family tradition and secured my place in the will, I guess. I made sure that I got some kind of inheritance by checking that Auburn box. But now I live in Auburn. As a child, if you had told me I was going to live in Auburn one day, probably wouldn't have believed it. It was the place that we went for family reunions, for funerals, for football games and tailgates. But I didn't think that I would ever live there. And it's such a blessing to be here and to raise a family here.
That's really remarkable. It sounds like I was appreciating hearing the story of the 19th century log rolling and backstabbing shenanigans in the legislature to establish the university. But it seems like Auburn's a place that's deeply shaped by this century and a half long tradition going back. That's sort of the local feel of the place is an Auburn University feel. Is that fair to say?
I think that's correct. You know, universities have their own traditions that are centered around tailgates and pep rallies. And when I take my son to a football game, there's a sense of belongingness that you get when you associate your surrounds with what your grandparents were doing. All my grandparents were doing this too. I can walk on campus and I can see the building where my grandfather taught math. I can walk in the buildings where my parents were students, where they met, where they dated at Auburn. I can point out the rooms they were in. I can see the houses that my grandparents lived in when they were married students. And just all the memories I have from when I was 3, 4, 5, 6 at tailgates, and to watch my sons and daughters go through the same experience is very powerful. You know, Edmund Burke has this phrase of a sense of belonging, where you're the partnership between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are to be born. And I think you get that just being in a university town, especially when you're tied to the university, because you feel part of a network that spans generations. You know, it's very common in many places for there to be generational divide, for the older generation to dislike something about the younger generation, or the younger generation to dislike something about the older generation. But universities tend to transcend those tensions because everybody sort of becomes part of these same traditions, and young people are cheering for the same team as their 80-year-old grandfather, and you know, their dads are yelling down at the field too. And that generational tension is somewhat gone when everybody's rooting for the same athletic program, or feels at one with the same ethos, the same community. And I think there's something important to be said about tradition just in that sense alone, that it can unite people across generations. It has that power, that sense of connectedness.
Now that you mention it, I'm actually struggling to think of another institution, especially in a small, non-super urban setting, that really does maintain its identity and that remains relatively unchanged, maybe mostly in its physical plant, but also in terms of its identity, the name of its mascot, the culture that one cheers for and takes part in across decades and decades, or even more than a century. I mean, professional sports teams move from city to city. Are there any others like that? Can you think of any?
Well, not really. I mean, universities are almost little cities unto themselves, especially when they're in somewhat rural settings. I mean, Auburn's population, 80,000, which by comparison to Montgomery is an hour down the road, and it's 198,000. Opelika is right next door, and it's about 32,000. And Auburn and Opelika are sister cities. I actually go to church in Opelika, and my kids attend a classical Christian school in Opelika, and it's a 15-minute drive from my house to their school. So I can't think of something that's quite like that, because even if you're thinking about athletic teams, like I grew up a Braves fan. I grew up loving the Atlanta Braves, and I grew up loving the Atlanta Hawks. If you can believe it, I've sort of abandoned the NBA. But, you know, even in cities like that, people may be able to unite around an athletics team, but there is a lot of fracture over pretty much everything else, including politics. And I'm not meaning to suggest that here in Auburn we are uniform in our political views. Very much the opposite case. In fact, there's a lot of division among the types of politics within the faculty, the sort of the town gown difference in politics, with the people of Auburn being much more conservative generally than the faculty. But the sense that there is a continuity, a tradition, a community that goes back before one's life and that will extend after one's life is inherently conservative. And no matter how left-wing your politics are as a faculty member, you tend to participate in it, regardless of whether you like it or not. You know, sort of an interesting thought that's occurring to me is DEI is a big issue in politics. In Alabama, we just We just passed a bill this week. It's going to be enacted into law that bans different DEI programming at public universities. And I think that this emphasis on inclusion in the DEI prong, this feeling that we need to make sure campuses are spaces of belonging, is so popular, and young people are so driven towards that desire because people have lost a coherent sense of identity. I think young people feel alienated and isolated. And if you're disconnected to the heritage and tradition of your ancestors, then you have little you want to preserve. You become radical and progressive because there's really no reason to be anything else. You just want change because there's nothing that you really want to preserve or no continuity that you feel a part of. And so no wonder you embrace things that actually, although nominally are about diversity, equity, and inclusion, are in fact about other things, like diversity becomes uniformity of thought and equity becomes leveling and actually disparate treatment of people, unequal treatment of people, and inclusion becomes exclusion of people who disagree with you or who think outside the acceptable scope of opinion.
I agree with you. I think there's something important there, but it occurs to me there's a sort of a paradox that the kind of community we've just been talking about, resident maybe in some especially historically rooted universities, doesn't seem to have headed off the demand for certain kinds of ideologically driven inclusion. I wonder if the reason for that has something to do with the way that communities, especially smaller rural communities, deal with, insiders and long-timers versus outsiders and welcoming outsiders. Do you have any experience with that or thoughts about that as someone who has these kind of four or five generation roots in the area?
Well, I think one difference is young people in particular, are coming to college without a sense of place, without a rootedness that maybe previous generations experienced. And they are plugged into technology in a way that previous generations were not, so that they can keep in touch with people or make friends with people who are in California or New York or China or Vietnam, wherever. And they can maintain those relationships. They play video games with people who are all over the world. And so their sense of place is perhaps a little different in that regard. Now, one thing that you bring up a really interesting point about the tension between sort of left-leaning faculty and their place in a university, and despite being part of a tradition or continuity or what is essentially a conservative institution, they bring their left-wing politics to it. But I actually think that almost in a lot of ways, the Western canon does that too. When you step through major thinkers throughout the canon, major philosophers, a lot of them were challenging the status quo. They were subversive of the culture in some way. And yet they are part of this textual network that makes them part of a tradition. Even if that tradition contains within it self-critique, it's still a tradition of working through problems and trying to find solutions and trying to improve. I don't by any means think that history is just a chain of progress. I think that there certainly is regress and there certainly is degeneration. And I believe that we are probably in some phase of that. But tradition itself isn't always about just building. Sometimes when you build, you have to tear things down. Sometimes you have to renovate. Sometimes you have to restore. Sometimes that means removing some bricks in order to put up some new ones or repainting.
That's a really good point. I appreciate that. I was having an image in my mind of one of the realities of university life is that the faculty and many of the administrators stay and then gradually grow older, as you and I do. But the students come and go, right? They're like a sort of a swiftly flowing river. They're here for 4 years or maybe for a little bit longer, and then they're gone. So they come not having been maybe from Auburn, most of them. And they come, they experience the university or any other university, mine or yours. And then they go away, having been changed, maybe not necessarily to settle in the immediate area, but they go away as people who feel a sense of belonging and identity with this institution. How do you think that affects the idea of the sort of rootedness in place of a university?
Well, it is interesting because it does suggest that a sense of place can be portable. I know that sounds like it's a contradiction, but basketball was playing on the television and I wanted to go watch it at a sports bar. And so I walked across Times Square and I went into some random Irish pub and I started looking around and there were Auburn University flags on the wall and there were photos of Auburn football players and basketball players everywhere. And I thought, this is the strangest thing. What have I walked into just by chance? I had no idea where I was going. I just put into Google Maps or whatever the closest pub. And when I looked around, there was Auburn stuff everywhere. And it turns out that in New York City, there are different bars that are sort of designated university settings. So if you're a Penn State fan, you know you go watch sports at this bar. Or if you're a Texas fan, the Texas Longhorns go and they meet in this bar. Well, I had just, and so the place was full of Auburn fans and everyone in there watching this basketball game. And there was a sense of community and place and solidarity, despite the fact that we were sitting there in New York City, which is full of deracinated people who come from all over the world. And it's a something of a melting pot or salad bowl, whatever metaphor you'd like to use. But we found an Auburn community with people who were, at least in my case, complete strangers. I can think of few instances where I could just walk into a random place in New York City and all of a sudden get so excited that I'm cheering with people I have never met in my entire life, getting emotional over stuff with people I've never seen, never heard of. And yet we instantly bonded. We instantly were giving high fives. I was hugging people I had never even seen before. And it was over athletics. You know, it sounds silly, but at the same time, it sounds profound.
Yeah, I agree that's really a remarkable way, especially larger institutions with many, many alumni. You can find them in many different places around the world. And there is a sort of portable, sort of small sense of place, which people carry with them, but always is tied back to the origin, right? It's not a sort of portable brand, but an actual connection to something real and concrete. What do you think of this particular dynamic about the building up of places? One of the things that my wife and I have experienced moving about 15 years ago to the small town we live in now is that we are, I think, still after even 15 years, still the guy that bought Joe's house. And I said to my wife when we realized this, you know, the difficulty of sort of becoming local is that we may never really be from here, but if we live here long enough, our kids will be from here and maybe they can bring their kids back here. But there seems to be a kind of multi-generational investment required in order to really build up a sense of place, even in your own family, and you seem to be profiting from 3 or 4 generations back worth of sticking to one place. But it does mean that people at every stage have to give up the goods that we often associate with mobility and willingness to move across the country to change jobs or to follow a career prospect, especially in academia for you and I. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I experienced similar phenomenon. I was the person who was part of the family who used to be plugged in here and he came back, but I wasn't the person who grew up here. I didn't go to high school here. I spent a lot of time here when I was in high school. I came to Auburn for many, many occasions, but I was never from here. And you're right that my children will be considered from here in a way that I wasn't. And there is, I think, an almost innocent exclusion that comes with that dynamic, in the sense that people who have their social circles and are used to inviting particular individuals to their houses or particular families over to the lake or to whatever it is, they just do what they've always done. And for them, that's just what's comfortable. And sometimes it's uncomfortable to bring a new person into the dynamic. And it's not that they are being malicious. It's just that they are doing what they're used to and what's comfortable for them, because they have stressful jobs too, and they want to relax and they want to just hang out and not have to worry about entertaining a new person. So even now, I've been here long enough that I'm probably guilty of that same sort of thing. I've fallen into my own habits and ways of life, and I probably exclude people that I shouldn't. I know I see new faces in our church, and I don't know their names, and I don't know who they are, and I haven't made an effort to get to know them, and that's bad. And I probably need to do a better job of that, because the place itself will be better. As far as growth goes, it's sort of interesting because every place is either in a state of growth or degrowth or some sort of decline. And economically, Auburn is in a state of growth, and it's the fastest growing metropolitan area in the state of Alabama. It's got a lot of new industry. The university is vibrant and it's bringing in a lot of new business. But there are a lot of other areas not too far away that are in rapid decline. And Auburn tends to sort of absorb those communities as people move away. Even if you just go down the road a short ways to Tuskegee, a historically Black college and university, it's a pretty desolate town. And it's got a really famous history tied into Booker T. Washington. And if you read The Invisible Man, you'll see what is a university campus based upon Tuskegee. But most Tuskegee students and faculty live somewhere else. They either live in Montgomery or they live in Auburn or even in Atlanta. Some of the faculty at Tuskegee commute all the way down from Atlanta. And
wow.
Yeah. I think all cities ought to aspire to growth or at least maintenance, but growth is something that can't occur in perpetuity, and it can occur in ways that are disruptive. And so it's a tough balance. I wish I had sort of the magical solution to the right rate of growth and how to do it effectively. I know that in my case in Auburn, I'm just sort of blessed to be somewhere where growth is happening, and it tends to be happening at a responsible and manageable rate and in a geographical location that can accommodate new people, and there is room to spread out.
That access to resources seems to make a tremendous difference. And it's certainly much, much easier, much more fortunate to be in a place which is sort of level or rising economically due to often many factors outside of the control of the people in the immediate area versus in a place that's declining. I've lived in some places, some towns, and I have some historical connections in my family history to towns that have been going through rapid decline the past half century, certainly. This, together with the point you were previously making, brings to mind again this idea of the treatment of outsiders versus insiders, or we might say winners versus losers, economically. And it seems to point, if among other things, towards the need for a certain kind of civic virtue, a virtue of hospitality, or a sort of attention to the blind spots that one develops after maybe decades in the same community. I have the same conversation with people in my church as well, that there are some new people over here. Let's make sure that we go out of our way to break our habits and welcome them in and speak to them and include them in the community. Sometimes that's based upon our prior experience of joining a new community and feeling like outsiders. There's a whole lot of information out there that you don't have. And as my wife and I used to say to each other, if we lived here, if we were insiders, we would already know that, but we don't because we're not plugged into those same networks.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I am a very harsh critic of ESG. You mentioned my talk at the Ciceronian Society, and I'm a critic of it, not just from an economics perspective. I'm not an economist. I just somewhere along the way fell into economics, got into Austrian economics. And so I participate in economics conferences. And some people even think I am an economist, but no, I'm just a lawyer with a PhD in English. But I'm also interested in why ESG is destructive in terms of psychology. So I believe that globalization has not transformed our bounded nature as situated human beings tied to distinct communities, communicating with preferred languages, and identifying with specific traditions and cultures. if you're an expat, if you're a drifter, if you're a vagabond, if you're deracinated, you're still going to have your prejudices and partialities, a place that feels more like home than another place, a language that's easier to speak, manners and mores that are more familiar, discrete groups with whom you enjoy an association. But ESG has as its end global governments. Global governance is actually the coined term that you see circulating in academic circles. It's a term used by the World Economic Forum. And ESG involves this coordination between governments, governments and private finance, investing, and banking. And it stamps out cultural pluralism and seeks to institute a managerial system of grand standardization, including unified laws and regulations across national borders. They're all tied to UN Sustainability Development Goals and very aspirational proclamations that intergovernmental organizations issue. And in my view, it's alienating to people. It makes them feel powerless. So in the face of overwhelming, if aspirational, global governance of ESG, people feel that they lack the agency or ability to facilitate change, resist, or direct the everyday elements of their jobs. They feel disempowered by forces too strong to oppose. ESG erodes your sense of local and regional culture, of generational attachment, of family pride, and of customs and traditions that really inform your lived experience. So I'm a critic of ESG, not just from an economic basis, but from a cultural basis, a societal, from a societal perspective, because I think it's the reason why people, why populism is occurring. People feel like I'm mad because I have nothing. I see all these wealthy people flying their private jets to Davos and all these billionaires socializing with presidents and prime ministers and treasurers and people from finance and banking, and I can't do anything about it. My opinion doesn't matter. I have no say. No one cares. I can't change this. And that's a tough thing when you're living in a purportedly democratic society and you feel as if you have no voice.
It certainly seems like we're thinking of some kind of maybe distant successor to what we used to know as the culture wars back in the day, that now it's not so much left versus right, red versus blue, or even urban versus rural so much as it is a kind of globalist uniformity mindset versus the whole variety, a whole sort of patchwork quilt of local regional identities and focuses. And that even it obtains psychologically within the sort of focus and the attention of each individual and you know, what kind of news sources we rely upon, where we devote our attention and what we worry about. And the like.
Well, I wish the left, and some are starting to wake up to it, to be fair, but I wish the left about ESG in terms of imperialism or colonialism. And I think just shifting to that framework will cause many people on the left, the academic sorts, the real thinkers, to reconsider what is actually happening here. If they thought of it in terms of colonialism or imperialism, they might start moving, in my view, in a different direction.
I think that's a great observation. That gives some hope for the future, perhaps. I think maybe some more creative thinking and some more attention to the rootedness and the particularity of our own identities, even for those of us in academia or who take part in some of these more global focused institutions. Let me ask you one final question then. What kind of resources would you recommend for somebody who wants to know more about Alabama, who wants to come to visit perhaps Auburn? Where should they go? Are there any sort of must-see sites or must-meet people that would really give them the flavor of the place?
Well, if you want to go to Auburn, you're probably better off flying into the Atlanta airport rather than Montgomery, because you can just drive right down from Atlanta. And if you transfer over from Atlanta to Montgomery, you may encounter what I encountered last weekend, which is a missing suitcase.
Oh, no.
that wasn't delivered until the next day, but that's okay. But if you go to Auburn, you'll want to see mostly the university campus and the surrounding areas. They're different. The downtown has different buildings that are sort of famous. There's Toomer's Corner, which is where you can get eliminated. It's where everybody rolls the trees with toilet paper after Auburn wins a football game or a significant basketball game. If you were going to come, I would recommend coming during an SEC football game, a big, like the Iron Bowl, the Auburn-Alabama game, something like that. I'll end just by saying, you know, a lot of people who are like me, generally conservative, and who are traditionalist, dislike college athletics. They think it's a corruption of the university. And I've never really taken that view, because I feel as if in the case of some place like Auburn, it brings in so much money that that subsidizes a lot of unprofitable areas of the university, but also because it is creating, athletics are creating, I guess I should say, a culture around a center of knowledge. The university still exists to expand the frontiers of knowledge, to contribute to the sum of knowledge. And the fact that it has athletics, even if they are very central to the identity of the place, I think only magnifies the central core purpose of the university. It helps the university do that. Are there athletes that wouldn't be at the university but for their athletic skills and they're not contributing that much to the academic project? Yes, absolutely. But there are trade-offs with everything, and that's a trade-off I'm willing to live with because they make it possible for other people who are very serious about the academic project to do what they do even better.
That's a great note for us to finish on. You've given me certainly a lot more to think about the nature of colleges, universities, and rootedness in place, in your specific place around Auburn, Alabama. Our guest today on The Sower has been Dr. Alan Mendelhall of Troy University. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Sower, please share it with a friend and rate us 5 stars. Go to our website, ciceroniansociety.org, for more information about our activities and mission.